Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Colombia's president and the leader of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia announced yesterday that they had reached a historic peace deal following talks in Havana, marking a huge step forward in concluding what has been a decades-long insurgency within Colombia.
Yesterday evening, a 15,000-strong crowd of activists gathered in Jackson, Mississippi to hear Donald Trump speak. But this rally had a special guest. The Republican Party presidential candidate was joined on stage by the UK Independence Party's Nigel Farage.
New legislation passed in the African nation of Angola will see the government take full control of the media and, controversially, allow a government crackdown on the use of social media, giving the ruling party further power to use the judiciary system to silence dissent.
The European Parliament's President Martin Schulz has said that a trade deal between the EU and the South American Mercosur bloc could be close to fruition, but that the United Kingdom will effectively be frozen out due to its decision to leave the EU back in June.
A new report by the UK Parliament Home Affairs Committee has stated that social media giants like Facebook, Twitter and YouTube are, quote, consciously failing to combat the use of their sites to promote terrorism and killings.
And a small town in Minnesota has reinstated Duke the Dog as its official town mayor.
Oh, that and more over the next half hour on this Thursday edition of World in Focus.
Colombia's President Juan Manuel Santos and the leader of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, more commonly referred to as the FARC rebels, Teomolion Jimenez, announced yesterday that they had reached a historic peace deal following talks in Havana. The deal marks a huge step forward in concluding what has been a decades-long insurgency within Colombia, and one which has claimed around 220,000 lives.
The FARC insurgency had its origins in a desire to bring a Marxist-style revolution to Colombia through guerrilla warfare, not dissimilar to the Cuban Revolution of the 1950s. However, as the years have gone by, those beginnings have grown into a long and bitter war inside the South American country, which for a long time looked like it may never end. The agreement reached yesterday, however, saw the Colombian president and FARC's leader shake hands on a deal which will see the insurgency soldiers disarm and reintegrate into Colombian society with support from the government.
Joining me on the line now from the Colombian capital, Bogota, is Oscar Palma, a professor of political science and government at the National University of Colombia. Thank you for talking to us, Professor Palma. After five decades, it looks very likely that a peace deal could have been reached. But how stable a peace do you think this can really deliver?
Well, I believe it depends on what you define as peace. The agreement that has been signed yesterday, it brings all the conditions to actually believe that we are able to construct something positive and balanced from now on in the future. But this doesn't mean that we're going to, from one day to another, we're going to immediately end all the causes of the conflict and then we're magically going to find peace from one day to another. It is a first starting point to go into a certain amount of political, economic and social processes that are going to be the construction of peace itself. There are more actors out there. There's still the ELN, which is another insurgency. We've got a lot of criminal bands which are dealing with narcotics. They will continue to exist in the country, and they are generating violence, and they're likely to continue conflictive circumstances and situations. So it's not immediate. It's not the solution itself. It's just one step. It's taking one of the major actors out of the war, but we still need to construct a lot more. So it's more like a first step into the construction that we need to do now.
Well, obviously, the FARC rebel group started out as a revolutionary political movement, and to all intents and purposes, still is. But over the years, as you pointed out there, it's kind of been accused of major drug trafficking operations and so on. How officially tied to FARC is that sort of drug trafficking network?
Yeah, absolutely. FARC has been dealing with drugs since 1982. In their seventh conference, it was accepted as one of the forms of financing. And since then, FARC participates in different stages of the cultivation and production chain. Now, it is not a uniform, it is not a monolithic participation through the country. What you find is different stages of involvement through different kind of regions. So in some regions of the country, you will find a deeper, a stronger participation in all the productions, all the stages of the production chain. In others, you will only see FARC involved in the early stages. But it is evident. I mean, there is no doubt about this. Colombians know there is evidence, massive evidence, to prove that FARC has participated in drug dealing activities. And some of the fronts that have already said, like, for example, front number one has already said that they will not join the peace agreement, that they will not demobilize. And one of the arguments is precisely because there's a lot of money on the drug dealing business. So it is one of the possibilities that we will see more members of the insurgency say that they will not join the accords, they will not demobilize, precisely because they're meddled into narcotics dynamics.
And those, of course, who are demobilizing seem intent now on going the way of forming a political party. Just what sort of level of support do you think that could carry in mainstream Colombian politics?
It depends on the level you analyze it. If you think at the national level politics, then you will find that FARC is quite marginal, and you're unlikely to see some support beyond, I don't know, 2% of the political spectrum. But if you go down to regional dynamics, and if you see what's going on locally in several areas and regions that have been strongholds of FARC for ages, for decades, you will see that you are likely to find some support there. So they have the strength to make constituency, to create constituencies in several of these more marginalized areas in the country. So it's more likely to find a political stronghold on the local level in those areas than on the national level politics.
Oscar Palmer, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Over to the United States now, and yesterday evening a 15,000-strong crowd of activists gathered in Jackson, Mississippi to hear Donald Trump speak. But this rally had a special guest who's probably more familiar to UK listeners than to those in the US. But nevertheless, the Republican presidential candidate gave him a pretty rousing introduction.
The man behind Brexit and a man who led brilliantly the United Kingdom Independence Party in this fight and won despite all odds, despite horrible name-calling, despite so many obstacles.
So who was Donald Trump referring to there? Well, it was the outgoing leader of the UK Independence Party, Nigel Farage. For listeners outside of the UK, Nigel Farage has arguably been the loudest and most consistent voice arguing for Britain to leave the European Union. Under his leadership, UKIP grew fairly well in local and EU parliamentary elections over the last 5 years, to the extent that the UK Conservative Party finally worked in an EU referendum to their 2015 manifesto.
UKIP, though, has been subject to a series of scandals, including the resignation of MEP Godfrey Bloom over sexist comments, a party official making donations to organisations connected to the far-right BNP, a councillor who was expelled after saying she, quote, had a problem with people with negroid features, not to mention notorious levels of infighting amongst the leadership of the party, too.
Donald Trump has previously expressed his support for Brexit. Indeed, he's even called himself Mr. Brexit, a moniker that Nigel Farage has also claimed. Both men see parallels between their respective campaigns, though. And here's Mr. Farage speaking to Trump supporters in Jackson yesterday.
You can go out. You can beat the pollsters. You can beat the commentators. You can beat Washington. And you'll do it by doing what we did for Brexit in Britain. We had our own people's army of ordinary citizens who went out and delivered leaflets, who went to meet people where they worked and where they socialised, who convinced and inspired people to go out if this was the one and only time in their life and to vote for change.
Nigel Farage of the UK Independence Party speaking there at a Donald Trump rally in Jackson, Mississippi yesterday. Trump and Farage both think that there are obvious parallels between their campaigns. Indeed, pretty much everyone would agree with them, but what exactly those parallels are presents a far more divisive picture. Trump and Farage see themselves as representatives of a people's movement, speaking up for supposedly ordinary voters who've been left behind by so-called elites or the political establishment.
Opponents of the men, however, would argue that they are united in appealing to xenophobia xenophobic fears over immigration and Islamophobia, Donald Trump's famous call to ban all Muslims from entering America, for example, or Farage's Brexit billboard campaign, which featured queues of refugees beneath the words breaking point. We did hope to get someone from UKIP onto the programme today to talk about this, but unfortunately, no one was available.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Still to come on the programme, new legislation passed in the African nation of Angola will see the government take full control of the media and controversially allow a government crackdown on the use of social media. We'll have more on that in just a moment.
The European Parliament's President Martin Schulz has said that a trade deal between the EU and the South American Mercosur bloc could be close to fruition, but that the United Kingdom will effectively be frozen out due to its decision to leave the EU back in June.
A new report by the UK Parliament Home Affairs Committee has stated that social media giants like Facebook, Twitter and YouTube are consciously failing to combat the use of their sites to promote terrorism and killings.
A small town in Minnesota has reinstated Duke the Dog as its official town mayor. New legislation in the African nation of Angola has come into effect, handing full control of all media to the government. While press censorship is not new in Angola, these new laws will also cover social media, allowing the government to crack down on the use of social media sites to organise political meetings and protests.
The Angolan government is viewed by many human rights groups as being highly undemocratic and authoritarian, while the president, Dos Santos, who has been in power for 37 years, won the 2012 elections with over 70% of the vote. Many reports stated that the election suffered serious flaws, with allegations of corruption and out-of-date electoral rolls, leaving many disenfranchised. Human Rights Watch have highlighted the arrest of several activists over the past few years, and their 2016 World Report states that, quote, freedom of expression continued to be severely restricted in Angola due to government repression, censorship and self-censorship in state media.
This has been contested by the government, who state that their laws on defamation and slander protect the interests of offended parties and do not restrict the freedom of expression. Joining us on the line is Professor Marissa Moorman from Indiana University. Professor Moorman, is this latest crackdown just par for the course for what's considered to be an authoritarian regime?
It is an authoritarian government. These are new developments. They're becoming much more legalistic in their approach to dissent. And they're trying, I think it's not just to control journalists, but they're actually looking to get political activists and critics of the government very much in particular, because those are the people that have been using social media more than anything else. Journalists, they already have a good degree of control over in a number of ways, because they control most of the media. Even the quote-unquote independent media is mostly controlled by people closely associated with the highest echelons of power in the state. So they're really trying to find new ways to control social media, which is what they've been greatly concerned with, and the president made a statement about that back in December. So this is really an attempt to kind of get a handle on these new forms of media and the ways in which political activists and other critics of the government, some among them journalists but human rights activists and others, have been using social media.
And there have been several arrests of protesters and quite a lot of crackdowns on protesters over the last few years. With Dos Santos having been in power for 37 years, and there were many criticisms of the 2012 elections. Human rights groups said that they were not run fairly and the electoral system was not a fair system. With these further crackdowns on protesters, is there any chance of next year's elections being more democratic at all?
It's unlikely, but, people still get involved. I mean, I think in some ways we have a very narrow conception of what constitutes democracy. I think elections are a very low bar. And I would say that the kind of taking politics to the streets that we've seen in Angola that's been happening since 2011 has actually mobilized Angolans and actually brought to consciousness the necessity for a different form of politics in Angola, and that's done greater work and matters more than electoral politics. So I think sometimes we need to, I think this kind of narrow focus on democratic elections doesn't necessarily serve us well. I think actually there's a lot of thinking, hard thinking, and hard work going on by average Angolans on the streets and in their homes, in conversations among themselves about what constitutes the kind of political system that they want to have. And that's more important than democratic elections. I mean, they matter, and the kind of state that they have matters, or they wouldn't be organizing. But I think our kind of, you know, the kind of narrow indicators that international organizations use don't really measure those things. But no, I mean, judged by those standards, no, they're not going to be democratic elections. But that doesn't mean that people aren't trying to do something or aren't thinking or aren't exercising some sort of political agency.
Though arguably these crackdowns on social media and on protesters surely will be having a negative impact on the ability of Angolans to come together and to actually talk about politics and talk about policies themselves, will it not?
Sure, but it also, I mean, people aren't stupid. They see that it's happening, and increasingly they're getting tired of it. And they're paying more attention. People used to pay, you know, for a while people were willing to cut the government some slack because there was an oil boom and it looked like things in everyday life were improving. That's no longer the case. So, you know, people can't afford to buy bread, and so people are less patient with the political narrowing and with the political crackdowns, because they're not getting the other things that they want and that they need.
Professor Merman, thank you very much for your time today.
Sure, it's my pleasure.
The European Parliament's President, Martin Schulz, has said that a trade deal between the EU and the South American Mercosur bloc could be close to fruition, but that the United Kingdom will effectively be frozen out due to its decision to leave the EU back in June. Mr. Schulz has been on a South American tour, taking in Argentina and Colombia, but even there, the issue of the UK's exit from the EU was an issue that came up. Here he is speaking to members of the press in the Argentine capital, Buenos Aires.
The European Union is not broken, but it needs a major reform. Both is right. For sure, we are not broken. The United Kingdom decided to leave the European Union. I find this very sad. For sure, a G7 country, the second economy of the single market of the European Union, a permanent veto power of the Security Council of the United Nations, leaving the European Union, that's for sure not good for the European Union, but also not for the United Kingdom.
EU President Martin Schulz talking to members of the press in Buenos Aires this week. One of the major topics on Schulz's agenda during his South American tour was the trade agreement between Europe and South America's trade bloc Mercosur. But Schulz made sure to point out that post-Brexit, the UK would not stand to benefit.
Mr. Schulz said, quote, "If the EU and Mercosur reach an integral agreement, the United Kingdom will not be part of the accord. This is a great disappointment, particularly for the UK." Joining me on the line now from Cardiff is Patrick Minford, Professor of Applied Economics at Cardiff University. Thanks so much for speaking to us, Professor Minford. Should the UK be concerned that it could be cut out of trade deals between the EU and Mercosur?
No, I don't think it is at all. The point is that all these trade agreements the EU makes are completely irrelevant to us. One of the things that is not really widely understood by people is that these trade agreements make no difference to our trade in world markets. They just divert trade from one place to another. If Mercosur, for example, did a trade agreement with us for purposes of argument and gave us preferential treatment, you know, in their markets, what would happen would be that would divert some of their market demand to our products and away from other people's products of the same sort. But, of course, you see, that's going to have no effect on total demand in world markets for those products, because it's just a diversion of demand from one group of, well, from us, from them to us. Mm-hmm. And so the world price of those products remains the same. So if you think about that, that means that, you know, our producers face the same world prices. So do the other guys' producers. It's simply a diversion of trade. And so what happens is that we produce the same, but we sell more in those countries and less in others. The other guys produce the same, sell less in those countries and more in others. So it's just a diversion of trade that happens with these trade agreements. Now, I'm not saying it isn't important to particular companies, but from the point of view of us as a trading nation, it makes no difference. And that's the big thing to grasp about all these trade agreements. They're basically irrelevant to us. What is relevant to us is the tariffs we ourselves, the protection we ourselves put when we leave the EU on other people's products, because that raises the price to our consumers, which is, of course, really important for our consumers and important for us as a country. And so our best policy is to not worry about all these trade agreements, but simply to go to what we call unilateral free trade, just get rid of all our barriers against world imports. So we buy things at world prices, you know, and our consumers get the best deals available around the world.
Well, accepting that you say there that you don't believe that trade partnerships are relevant particularly or necessary, obviously they do have an impact on international relations. How does this sort of trade agreement square with older ideas, would you say, about, for example, the transatlantic trade partnership, which has not moved on as quickly as its proponents would have maybe liked? Is a move closer with Mercosur in South America a sign of Europe perhaps shifting away from the US, or could it maybe signal even more integration in a way that might be compatible with TTIP?
Well, look, now you're going to ask me, you know, we're talking now about what is in the EU's interest, you know, in terms of its relationships with Latin America. Well, really, there's not much point, in my opinion, for the EU to sign these trade agreements with Latin America. For essentially the same reason that I just gave about our interests. But there's a further point about the EU. It's not clear that even if they try to make a trade agreement with Mercosur, it will ever get through the European ratification process. You know, we're now talking about the Canadian deal, which the EU took 7 years to negotiate, and it now looks as if it won't be ratified by the 38, you know, member regional and national parliaments of the EU, which it apparently has to be, you know, under EU treaty law. And so this is a big problem for the EU. When it tries to do these big trade agreements, you know, which they put a lot of publicity on, then it turns out they may not be able to do it because of opposition from one parliament's got a veto.
Patrick Minford, thank you so much for talking to us.
It's a pleasure.
According to a UK government report, social media giants like Facebook, Twitter and YouTube are, quote, consciously failing to combat the use of their sites to promote terrorism and killings. The report states that these sites have become, quote, the vehicle of choice in spreading propaganda and the recruiting platforms for terrorism.
The UK Parliament Home Affairs Committee found, following a 12-month investigation, that the companies have teams of only a few hundred employees to monitor networks of billions of accounts, and Twitter does not even proactively report extremist content to law enforcement agencies. Our reporter Jim Insom has been following the story. Jim, what's the background to this report?
Well, quite clearly, the terrorism threat is number one on the agenda throughout Europe. And as you will well know, radicalization is going on through both the net and social media, as well as on the dark net. And Daesh are clearly using YouTube and all social media as a means of publicity. And, of course, they're using it as an online tool for recruitment. So there have been questions asked over many, many times over the use of images on YouTube of, for instance, those beheadings of people by Daesh, and also the use of social media. And the question is, are the big companies that earn billions of pounds of profits, you know, companies such as Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, Google, and all the other social media sites, are they doing enough to work with law enforcement agencies to close down quickly any site that comes up, or even to actively deflect away their use by terrorist groups and groups like Daesh and Al-Qaeda and all of that. And that's the big issue that's been going on. And a question that's been asked all over Europe, and it's being asked by this UK House of Commons report, is, look, have they done enough to close down this as a method of giving the oxygen of publicity to terrorist groups? And that's why this report today is quite important.
And so that's the significance of today's report from the UK Home Affairs Committee. This is quite a new revelation.
They spent 12 months, apparently, and it's very interesting that most parliaments in Europe and the UK Parliament are in recess at the moment. And it's quite interesting that, you know, they choose a day like today to issue a very, very damning report. Because, I mean, what they say is they're consciously failing. That's their words. What they're saying is if they continue to tackle, I'm just looking at a copy of the report which I got overnight, if they continue to fail to tackle this issue and allow their platforms to become the Wild West of the internet, it will erode their reputations. Now, that's quite an interesting thing. And what they say is, here's another quote, they must accept that the hundreds of millions in revenues generated from billions of people using their products needs to be accompanied by a greater sense of responsibility and ownership from the impact that extremist material on their sites is having. Now, what they're doing very cleverly is they're saying, look, guys, you have, as they do, they have shareholders, and there is corporate social responsibility claims on behalf of their shareholders. So with profits goes corporate social responsibility. And the suggestion, reading through the report, it goes into many, many pages, as you imagine these things do. But what they're saying is, look, you may have some tools, some algorithmic tools to try and weed out and take down some of the millions and millions of uploads that go up, and you can instantly do word searches and take them down. But you're simply not putting enough money into having people actively looking at what's being put up and actively taking it down. And the suggestion is that they've only got sort of a few hundred people, you know, working on taking millions of items down.
Mm-hmm. And so, just finally, where does this leave the major internet companies then in the fight against terrorism?
Good question. And as they point out, it's a question of brand and image. Because basically, if they, the House of Commons Select Committee today, and others, and I'm sure others will follow on this one, and privacy groups, if they say, look, guys, you are failing in social responsibility, you are therefore failing your brand. And big brands like Twitter, YouTube, Facebook, and Google, if your brand is seen to be failing and seen to be used by terrorist groups, then actually you are failing in your social responsibility, and therefore your brand and your reputation would fail. And that's the key thing to this announcement today.
Well, Jim Insom, thank you.
The European Commission has launched a series of investigations into companies making use of benign tax arrangements in Ireland, Luxembourg and the Netherlands in order to reduce its tax bills on profits made in other EU member states.
However, the United States Treasury have published a report stating that the Commission has changed its approach to tax arrangements, classing them as state aid, which is banned under EU rules. The report stated, quote, the Commission is seeking to recover amounts related to tax years prior to the announcement of this new approach, in effect seeking retroactive recoveries. Because the Commission's approach departs from prior practice, it should not be applied retroactively.
This intervention in EU affairs amid rising opposition to US firms using aggressive tax measures to reduce their tax bills in EU states comes at a critical time as the US is trying to push through the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, or TTIP, trade deal. The strong language in the report backing the US-based companies could be seen by many critics of TTIP as a sign that the US is using the trade agreement to favour US firms doing business in the EU. There has already been criticism of the US side attempting to water down strict EU standards on food and pharmaceutical safety, the environment and workers' rights.
And finally, the town of Cormorant in Minnesota has re-elected a dog as a mayor.
Hold on, re-elected? You mean this is the second time they've elected a dog?
It's actually the third time. Duke is very highly regarded and now for the third year running has beaten all the human competition to keep his job as town mayor.
So, right, there is an actual mayor though, a human mayor that's carrying out all the mayor responsibilities and doing the mayor things?
Well, I don't think so. I'm not entirely sure that the role of mayor is really that important. Another town in Minnesota has had a series of toddlers as mayor for the past few years.
I think the role of mayor is pretty important.
Well, it might be, but
take that up with Boris Johnson, London mayor.
Apparently the dog does a really good job of welcoming people to the town, though, and he is really cute. He's got a little hat on as well.
Yeah, but you're one of these people that likes to put clothes on dogs.
I do not put clothes on dogs.
I've seen pictures of your dog with a bow tie and a hat.
He looks really cute in his bow tie.
Does it not have a coat as well?
Maybe for the winter.
Unfortunately, that is all we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget, you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio.
This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott.
And me, Jack Foster.
Goodbye.